Time to speed up coral evolution. Global warming threatens our reefs. Some marine scientists have a controversial plan to save them. Elizabeth Finkel explains. Now, I should explain myself. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific and open up a conversation. The overall idea is that by just hammering my skill in podcasting, I'll eventually improve and you might enjoy some things along the way. That's the general idea, and hopefully I'll get there. I've got a way to go to get my brain into gear. The foreword for this is the Australian Institute of Marine Science is a glorious place. From sultry Townsville in the far north Queensland, it's a lush 50-kilometre drive east through sugarcane and mango plantations across an estuary through a scrub till finally you crest a hill and you are hit by a blue expanse of the Pacific Ocean. Beautifully written, Mr. Finkel. A primeval atmosphere reigns at Cape Ferguson. Signs on the dock warn of crocodiles, sharks and snakes. Everything is protected and thrillingly feral. Something quite wild is happening inside the buildings too. Here, marine biologist Madeleine Van Oppen and colleagues are pursuing a bold and controversial goal to speed up the evolution of corals to ensure the survival of the world's reefs, particularly the one on the Institute's doorstep. The 2,300-kilometre-long Great Barrier Reef. Their research, once considered fringe, has gone mainstream. In January, the Australian government committed $6 million to the study of the feasibility of helping reefs adapt to climate change. AIMS and CSIRO, the National Science Agency, are leading this study, which brings together leading reef conservation and research bodies. The Great Barrier Reef Marine Park Authority, which raises funds for scientific research, the University of Queensland, the Queensland University of Technology, and the James Cook University. Assessing the evolution of coral is a radical departure from historically conservative agenda on the reef's custodians. Most of the efforts have been to combat local threats like agricultural runoff and predatory starfish. Put the back-to-back bleaching events of 2016 and 17 rammed home the greater existential threats from global warming. The narrative that is, it will be our kids who will have to deal with the climate change is obsolete, says Paul Hardesty, the head of the AIMS. We're out of time. Action has to happen now. The funding is just one-tenth of the $60 million reef protection package announced by the federal government, with the bulk of the dedicated to reducing industrial impacts on water quality and management of starfish. But the results of the feasibility study may open funding floodgates. How much is it worth spending to save the reef? Its ecological value is immeasurable, but its economic value can be calculated. According to analysis by the Deloitte Access Economics, the reef tourism contributes more than $6 billion a year to the Australian economy. Add in the services to fishery and coastal protection, it's an asset valued at $56 billion, surely worth a sizable chunk of the research dollars to save it. Marine scientists, however, are hardly comrades in arms on the merits of accelerated evolution. While some feel compelled to try and preserve a functional reef, others think the ambition is flawed and futile. They say the scale of the reef is too vast for science to slow the decline, and any success may well defeat the purpose. Rather than preserving the diversity of its 400-plus hard coral species, it might produce a reef dominated by a few coral superweeds. One of my main objections is it's more likely to do more harm than good, said Andrew Beard, an ecologist at James Cook University. Yet another point is to the dazzling march of the technology and say we must at least explore the outlandish possibilities. The event of CRISPR gene editing is an oft-cited example. 6 years ago, no one would have predicted we could there would be a cheap, precise, universally deployable tool for rewriting the code of genes, or that gene drives would be capable of rapidly altering the genetic makeup of entire populations. Maybe within the next few decades, the argument goes, science will deliver tools to drive evolution just where we want it to go. Of course, nothing will save the coral if the greenhouse gas emissions don't cease. Coral is the canary of the in the coal mine. It's exquisitely sensitive to increase in water temperature. Just a degree above normal maximum for several weeks is enough to cause bleaching and death. If the Paris Accord holds and emissions cease by 2050, the hope is assisted evolution will buy the time for the coral to adapt to the 1 to 2 degrees warming. Scientists contemplating such possibilities say it's not just up to them to decide, they are looking to the public for permission. We try to engage the public at forums and talk openly to the media. It's about being transparent, says Van Oppen. So sooner or later, we're going to have to ask this question. How far should we go to try to save our reefs? Assist the evolution of coral? It's a simple proposition. We know the Great Barrier Reef is a resilient ecosystem. Around 100,000 years ago, there was no Great Barrier Reef. Vast ice sheets had locked up the planet's water and left the ancient earlier reef high and dry. As the ice sheet thawed, the sea levels rose. The reef slowly returned over the last 8,000 to 9,000 years, with species adapted to the new conditions. No doubt the reef will ultimately evolve new species and uncovered in this time too, but we don't want to wait 9,000 years. We've been assisting the evolution of species ever since we began domesticating crops and animals some 10,000 years ago. Today, wheat varieties, for example, bear a little resemblance to their weedy ancestors. Coral, however, is not wheat. It is the keystone species of a wild ecosystem, and the ethos of conserving wilderness, forests, savannas, seagrass, meadows, and reefs has always been to preserve, not change. Historically, the custodians of the Great Barrier Reef have adhered to this ethos. They cordoned off areas, stopped overfishing, regulated tourism, tried to keep waters clean, and battled outbreaks of the crown of thorns and starfish. The strategy seemed to be working. In 2010, for example, the global bleaching events triggered by warm oceans hammered reefs across the Pacific, Indian Ocean, Caribbean, and Arabian Gulf. But the Great Barrier Reef was largely spared. Some thought the reef was too big to fail. Not so. The back-to-back bleaching events of 2016 and 2017 delivered the global coral apocalypse to the Australian shores. The 2016 event, like previous mass bleaching, was linked to the warming of the Pacific waters produced by an El Nino weather pattern. The second was not. It took everyone by surprise. Adding up the damage from the onslaught, GMRMPA estimates about half the reefs have died. The scale of these impacts operating is like nothing we've ever seen before, said David Watchfield, Grandpa's G. Brumera, Director of Reef Recovery. For Watchfield, business as usual is no longer an option. It's a moment in history where, when it comes to the protection of reef systems, even one as big as robust as the Great Barrier Reef, we have to rethink how we're doing this. When it comes to assisting evolution of coral, Van Oppen and an athletic, affable woman in her early 50s, okay, she's looking good for her 50s, I felt it was just a matter of time. Originally from the Netherlands, one of her first projects led her to East Africa's Lake Maui, to plumb the mystery of how 700 species of chelid fish had evolved so rapidly. She never dreamed that 20 years on she would use her knowledge to speed up the evolution of corals in the Australian Great Barrier Reef. In 2008, based in Ames, she began trying to interbreed more heat-resistant Alcor Melba corals to the Orphis Island with the Sully Reefs in Keppel Island. With the first attempt, floodwaters washed away the experiment hybrids, and yet again the following year. It was hard to find the funding to repeat the experiment. The key focus at the time was managing the clear and present dangers of the crown and thorn invasion and the runoff from rivers that clouded and contaminated the waters of the inshore reefs. Corals, especially juveniles, need clear, clean water to thrive and repair the incessant damage wrought by starfish and cyclones. But often found a like mound in coral research, Ruth Gates of the University of Hawaii. Hawaiian reefs, though never biodiverse as the Great Barrier Reef, had been decimated by bleaching events and sewage runoff. My God. In 2013, collaborators attracted the attention of Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen's philanthropic foundation, winning a small $10,000 exploratory grant. 2 years later, in 2015, after the 2010 bleaching event had hammered the corals of Canal Bay, the foundation kicked the research into high gear with a $4 million 5-year grant to develop a biological toolbox for creating a stockpile of corals with improved environmental stress resilience, which can be used to stabilize and restore reefs. When the first bleaching hit Australia in 2016, Van Oppen found herself in the right place at the right time. As the global media reported the apocalypse scenes of mass bleaching, tepid waters thick with the ooze of dying corals, weeping scientists, and widespread reef grief, Van Oppen, once obscure research, was showcased on the BBC's David Attenborough and Australian ABC's Catalyst program. But it wasn't just the media that began taking serious interest in her work. As the reef's custodian, GBRMPA, wrestled with how to manage the national treasure in the face of coral apocalypse and began to take notes of Van Oppen's work, helping to recast it from fringe to trailblazing. The current 18-month feasibility study is a hard-headed assessment of the tools available to help the reefscape adapt. How it could be done at scale and at what cost? Besides larval seeding, underwater fans and shade cloth, these tools include a biological toolkit developed by Van Oppen. So what exactly does a coral biological tool contain? Lots. It involves tweaking the genes of coral as well as a community of organisms that reside within it. The problem is that no one has ever tried to tweak genes before. We've been careful not to overpromise, said Van Oppen. Let's be clear, coral is not a wheat plant. We've had thousands of years' experience tweaking the genes of wheat. We can make crossbreeds that will map out desired traits in the DNA, usher them into new varieties. Breeding has produced fantastic success. Modern wheats have more than doubled their yield since 1950. Every few years, leaders bring out new varieties, better adapted to the latest strain of fungus and better able to tolerate drought or salt. Nothing like this is possible with any coral reef species, let alone hundreds of Great Barrier Reef species one would want to assist. Van Oppen and her colleagues are hoping to contract thousands of years of wheat tweaking experience into a decade contractor. Their source of optimism lies in the fact that coral naturally has some tricks up its sleeves. On any bleach reef, some corals will survive. The question is why. It all comes down to ecosystems. A mature coral head is a colony of millions of genetically identical polyps, tiny, delicate, anemone-like organisms that build limestone houses around themselves, which form the structure of coral reefs. Every tiny pinprick in the limestone is a place a living polyp calls home. Each polyp houses an invisible community of diverse microbes which its body within its body tissue. Life did not take over the world by combat, but by networking, wrote evolutionary biologist Lynn Margulis. Corals take networking to a whole new level. What that means is researchers have to consider more than just the corals' genes if they want to speed up their evolution. For starters, there are genes in of their most famous cohabitants, various types of single-cell algae, collectively known as zooxanthellae, or Cymbolidium. Juvenile polyps swallow these algae, but instead of digesting them, they usher them into purpose-built compartments within the outer cells of a polyp. Like all plants, algae make sugar from sunlight via a set of chemical reactions called photosynthesis, and they provide the coral with a host of 90% of their calorie requirements. That powers the coral's monumental limestone building project, waters that are otherwise low in nutrients. The need for sunlight is why corals are so valuable to poor quality water, which can smother coral in sediment and block the sun. But heat is the worst stress of all. When temperatures stay too high for a week or two, vital coral algae partnership breaks down. The heat plays havoc with the algae's photosynthetic reactions, causing them to release increased amounts of damaging chemicals called oxidants. In the face of toxic assault, the polyps begin evicting the residents. Some corals fluoresce a dazzling shade of electric blue in the process, perhaps in an attempt to soak up the excessive energy of oxidants. But the show is short-lived. Once the algae are evicted, the tan brown colour of healthy coral bleaches to white. It's possible for the polyps to recolonize if they are not the coral stars to death over a few weeks. The eviction is not always the outcome. There's evidence that suggests that genes in algae play a role in determining how well the partnership survives. For instance, back in 2006, Van Oppen and colleagues' corals from Cable Island to warmer waters, transplanted to warmer waters. In Magnetic Island, 600 kilometres further north, the corals that survived had traded their old algae partners, clad C, to the more tolerant clad D types. The Sedonium partnership is crucial to the polyp, but it's not the only one. Turns out microbes play an important role in the polyp's health, much like they do in human health. Once considered invaders, the microbial community that inhabits our body orifices, the microbiome, is now linked to an ever-growing list of vital functions, including taming our immune system and contributing to the health of our gut, liver, and even brain. The latest thinking is that coral polyps sitting right at the base of the evolutionary tree, next to sponges, also relies on microbiome for its health and immunity. The coral microbiome resides in the coral's mucus coating, gut, and skeleton. It is effectively a chemical factory that produces a diverse range of products, including nitrogen-sulfur-containing compounds. Van Oppen suspects that the repertoire extends to antioxidants, chemicals that could neutralize the oxidants produced during coral bleaching. If that's the case, it might just be the genes of the coral microbiome that help it survive heat stress. Finally, corals seem to have one more trick up their sleeve. Some colonies appear to adjust to heat stress in the same way a tomato plants do. They gradually get used to it. Gardeners harden tomato seedlings by gradually exposing them to warmer and warmer temperature. The mechanism dubbed epigenetic does not alter the DNA code, but reprograms it by attaching chemicals such as methyl groups. There are glimmers of hope that corals can acclimatize a gradual change based on what happened to the reefs exposed in the devastating Indian Ocean mass bleaching event of 1998. When the 2010 bleaching event arrived 12 years later, those corals that had survived the early event appeared to be more resilient. However, the bleaching of 2016-17 dashed any hope for the Great Barrier Reef. Whatever hardening took place wasn't enough to protect the reef. But Oppen and her colleagues now tinkering with the four components of the coral genetic toolbox: coral genes, algae genes, microbial genes, and epigenetic hardening. The most of the tinkering is taking place at Ames in the wilds of Cape Ferguson. Away from the crocodiles, sharks, and snakes, scientists can safely carry out their experiments in what may be the world's most sophisticated simulation of the sea. The $4 million Sea Sim Aquarium, which has state-of-the-art control rooms and the same design specs as those of the nuclear reactor. Scientists can observe remarkable things by programming the slow ramping rhythms of the sea, the waxing and waning of daylight and temperature, the CO2 levels that climb gradually at night as plants cease photosynthesis, the consumption of gas. The computers can also precisely simulate the deposition of fine sediments, a feat that revealed for the first time how coral sheds their mucus coating like a glove to rid the surface sediment. Before scientists unleash any evolutionary fast-track coral to the reef, the impact will be simulated at sea sim first. Sea sim may be safer than the waters of Cape Ferguson, but things get pretty feral here at spawning season. Once a year, generally on a November night, after a full moon, corals spawn. On the reef, it happens en masse. The waters turn cloudy with trillions of eggs and sperm. Before November, scientists from around the world pluck corals from the reef and bring them to CSIM. But not every coral species joins on cue. They may be out of sync by hours or weeks, so breeders will stay up all night watching and waiting for the first signs of corals are about to eject their tiny bundles of sperm and eggs. They collect bundles, strain the sperm and the eggs, and wait for the next species to spawn. It's a harrowing wait. They have only a couple of hours before they've captured sperm and eggs die. AIM researcher Lisa Pepto shows me a tank bearing the results of crossbreeding experimentation with four species. She, Van Oppen, and a PhD student, Win Chang, have tested juvenile corals under the conditions of today and predicted for the middle of the century 1 degree and 685 parts per million. I remember we have 400 CO2. Encouragingly, some hybrid crosses show greater survival than their parents under both conditions. Another corner of CSIM, I'm guided by Lion Bay, a Dane who visited the Great Barrier Reef. My God. A snorkeling holiday in 44 and never left. Bay, together with Kate Quingley, are testing for genes of corals that survived the 2016 mass bleaching in the Northern Reef. They took cuttings of Kabora survivors and brought them to CSIM. When they spawned, they crossed with a Kabora, a more southerly locale. The offspring is being tested to see if they have inherited the heat resistance genes. Bay also takes me to the external area of CSIM where the tanks are covered by shade cloth. Here, hardening experiments are underway with the experiment dubbed Evolution 21. A mix of reef species will be followed under different climatic conditions for 5 years. Bay has long-standing interest in how corals tune to the local environments. She points out that coral larvae the size of rice grain can last up for 100 days in the ocean, attracted by the smell of coral. Oh, okay. They may reach another reef with conditions quite different from those parents. Perhaps, like tomato season, corals rely on hardening for local tuning. And could such a tuning be inherited? The spiny damselfish, for instance, appears to pass on its heats acclimatization to its offsprings. Lamarck, amazing. To test the coral hardening and inheritance, the Bay is studying the coral species Acorolopus and Plagiatira dorae, reared under the extreme climatic regime. If she can establish the heat hardening of the larvae, it could have an impact. More than 90% of the larvae die in the first 9 months, so seedling reefs with heat-hardened larvae could boost populations. Beyond the futuristic contours of CSIM facility, by some more ordinary-looking buildings, one houses a lab where Van Oppen and her colleagues are trying to breed algae that hang in there with their coral partners when the heat is on. They extracted algae from coral and grew some 80 generations in temperatures of 31 degrees, conditions that should select for heat-tolerant individuals. These survivors were inoculated with coral larvae. Then the partners tested for the heat tolerance. So far, only a small benefit has been seen. The next step will be to accelerate mutation rate of algae using mutagenic chemicals. The final toolkit, the final tool in the kit I visit Van Oppen at the University of Melbourne lab that she runs jointly with microbiologist Linda Backall. It's nested away in what used to be the botany building, an ivy-covered red brick pile with cross-hatched white window panes and Gothic oversized wooden doors set in stone archway is the year 1929 carved above. It is a quaint setting for a decidedly avant-garde experiments. You've heard of probiotics for human health, concoction of healthy bacteria taking yogurt, pills and even fecal transplants to treat conditions like inflammatory bowel disease. Here, the goal is to develop a probiotic for coral. The model animal upon which the probiotics will be tested is the starburst-like pale anemone, whatever it is, best known as the aquarium pest. Like its coral polyp cousin, it relies on symbiosis with algae and bleaches when the temperatures rise too high. In its mucous tissue and stomach, it houses a community of bacteria. PhD student Leon Hartman has been learning how to grow these pretty creatures for the past 2 years. It's a major job, filtering Melbourne's water, adding sea salt, hatching brine shrimp to feed them. They prefer their food live. That's right, polyps aren't they eating. Okay. He is growing the anemones under an elevated temperature to see what sort of bacteria associate with survivors. Ashley Duncan, another PhD student, takes Hartman's carefully tended anemones and mercilessly squashes them, pretty easily giving the skins only 4 cell layers thick. Bugan streaks out the anemone soup onto an agar-coated petri dish, spreading so thinly that a single bacteria will grow around a pink and brown colonies. Did any of the bacteria help the enemy host resist bleaching? Duncan is teaching each bacterial clone for its ability to neutralise oxidants. The hope is that to find a soothing concoction that can be made coral less prone to boot out the bothered algae. Van Oppen and her colleagues are testing all 4 coral tools to see if they can tighten the nuts and bolts on the multi-component coral organism to create individuals that can withstand conditions predicted for the rest of the century. How many fast-track coral species could be needed to maintain a functional reef? Van Oppen guesses several dozens, spanning the range of morphologies, branch, massive, and encrusting. Seeding strategies like the one now being tested on the degraded patch of reef near Heron Island would be scaled up to deliver genetically, epigenetically, or microbially hardened new recruits, to disperse them across vast distance. A strategic set of reefs would be targeted, those known to be part of the ocean highway whose currents connect key reefs within the 3,000 strong chain. Though it's very early days, many researchers hope science can deliver a solution to buy coral's time. Ames Paul Hardisky says simply, "I'm an optimist. Other researchers are not." At Ames' closest neighbour, the RC Centre for Excellence in Coral Reef Studies at James Cook University, it's not hard to find researchers deeply sceptical of assisted evolution. The director, Terry Hughes, has expressed concerns that any idea of an engineered solution for threatened reefs distracts from the main game, which is reducing carbon dioxide emissions. But the key scientific repository is that assisted evolution represents a futile ambition. JCU ecologist Baird, Dalens Cop University ecologist Baird, offers a reality check. Think how much time and money it took for Monsanto to engineer just a soybean. Probably more effort has gone into ecology in the history of the universe. And he concludes, "I honestly believe the time, energy, and intellect required is well and truly beyond anything the reef community can muster." Ove Holdenberg, a bleaching expert and director, and now director of the Global Change Institute at the University of Queensland, sees merits in both positions. While he likens assisted evolution project to gardening on the scale of Italy, it's not willing to turn its back on anything. All options are on the table, and we will put a ruler all over them. Emma Johnson, marine ecologist at the University of New South Wales, has felt the weight of the divided views more than most. As a grandpa boar mender, she has had to decide whether to back the option of assisted evolution. She chose to support it. "What we are facing now is a terrible realization that by not doing anything, we're risking the reef as much as if we intervene," she says. But that decision wasn't easy. "I had to struggle," she said. "I think all these people are right."